In the news.
Welcome to In the News. I'm Eric McDaniel.
And I'm Jim Henson.
All right, so this week we want to start off, as we have most weeks, talking about the primaries. We have results from a few more states. We want to start with the Democratic primary, where we see that Hillary Clinton was able to win Mississippi, but Bernie Sanders was able to come through with a surprise and win the state of Michigan.
That's a burn.
Yeah.
I mean, the Michigan, huge surprise, really. I mean, I think maybe not as huge in the last few days, but going into this, Midwestern state, substantial black population, large unionized labor force, not as large as it used to be, but large unionized labor force, and yet Sanders edged Clinton out only by 2 points. But nonetheless, another kind of rough night for Hillary Clinton, right, Eric? I mean, Hillary Clinton keeps looking to wrap this thing up, and she just can't do it. She just can't seem to close the deal and put Bernie out.
Yeah, it's like an old school WWE wrestling match where, you know, the guy's about to put him down. You get one, two, then he pops out. So hopefully, you know, I think she wants to pin Bernie as quickly as possible and move on to really the general election, get this wrapped up as quickly as possible, and basically get her money and funds and her focus and actually her message directed towards the general election, so she can kind of get away from the partisan rhetoric that she has to push at this point.
Yeah, I think we don't want to wallow in tactics too much, but it does seem like, you know, she had a pretty good Super Tuesday, obviously, and it looks like she may have pivoted a little bit too soon to talking about the general election. I mean, she was talking general election style right after the Super Tuesday victories, and then this came along. They're going to have to backslide. It is worth noticing also she won very big in Mississippi, another big Southern win, a state with a much larger minority, in this case African-American population. Very good for her. Also, four primaries actually primaries and caucuses on the Republican side last night. Another very good night for Donald Trump. Trump wins in Hawaii in the biggest prizes, wins in Michigan and Mississippi. Doesn't break 50% in either of those races. Ted Cruz manages to win Idaho. Idaho, very conservative, very white, and you know, has a little bit of a fringe element there, probably going in. Not surprisingly, that was a good state for Cruz. So Cruz and Trump take first and second for the most part, entirely. Kasich was competitive in Michigan. He's from Ohio in the region. Kasich, but Cruz still beats Kasich by a point. But also a bad night for, as Donald Trump keeps calling him,
Little Marco.
Yeah, I felt a little bad about doing that, but I can't really help it. That's part of the Trump thing, I guess. He does these things and you can't help it.
Yeah, I mean, given the fallout from the Republican latest Republican debate, where we there's a lot of discussion of hand size and what that's linked to.
IQ.
Yes. I have a nice sized IQ myself. But the issue here is, you know, it's gotten really, Rubio is really trying to find a way to stay in the fight, and it's just not happening. I guess he'll try to stay till Florida, and if he gets beat in Florida, it's time to go. And then, the people are saying, okay, it's time to go. And really, Kasich is kind of the forgotten individual in this. Kasich's like, look, I'm the adult in the room with all this yelling back and forth, but it's... No, it just ain't going to work.
I think we talked last week about the kind of game of chicken that's going on the second, you know, it's not so much Cruz anymore. Now it's really Rubio and Kasich kind of waiting for the other guy to get out. Rubio's got a real problem. I mean, he's probably not going to get out. And the Cruz campaign has once again gotten in trouble for this technique where they see a mistaken report on CNN and they tweet it out right away before the correction can be made. And so once again last night, they were circulating rumors that Rubio was going to get out in order to kind of hurt Rubio and pad their vote. But Rubio's got a real problem. I mean, the poll average for Rubio in his home state of Florida, which is, people are saying must win all the time in these races. Florida is must win for Rubio. And he's, I think the polling average, like 16 points, he's behind Trump. He's behind Trump by about 16 and a half points in the average of the polls. just does not look good for Rubio.
No, and I mean, you see this, you know, the Mitt Romney and John McCain kind of pushing like anybody but Trump, but it's looking like it's not going to happen. And you see Trump talking about the idea of I'm a unifier last week, then also talking about unity this week. Of, you know, I'll bring the party together. It's okay. I'll bring the party together. And it's really becoming problematic for the party. People are saying the party is looking like a laughingstock because of what Trump has done. But the key thing we need to remember is that, you know, a lot of people may not like Donald Trump, but Donald Trump is tapping into something. And that's what you have to do to win an election. You tap into something. It may be the good, the bad, and the ugly, but, you know, you tap into something and you use that to get into the White House. And he's tapped into something in the American public. We may not like what he's tapped into in the American public, but it's there and we need to acknowledge it. And by kind of ignoring it or treating it as if it's not important, we're really missing the message. In many ways, we're missing out on this kind of underlying basically revolt that is coming about.
And we've seen a lot of discussion in the last, you know, between the last podcast or the last broadcast and this one, in which Republican leaders, stakeholders, elites have invested even more heavily in trying to knock Trump out. Trump talked about that last night in his victory speech after Michigan, which in itself was, even for Donald Trump, was a pretty weird affair. We don't have video of that, it was too late. But Trump, you know, gave a lot of the usual riffs, picked on his opponents, was calling Ted Cruz Lion Ted, but also as a way of pushing back on the idea that he had not been a successful business person, had an array of his products there. So this victory speech began to look like an infomercial where he was talking about steaks and his beautiful wineries and all his products. It was very weird, and is only going to get weirder, I think, as we go on. But I guess at this point we should move on to something a little less disturbing. So how about we talk about the Zika virus?
I mean, we don't really mean to make a transition from Trump to viruses, but it sometimes that's how it goes. So there's a great deal of attention to the Zika virus, and we have a real quick clip to kind of explain why there's so much concern about the virus.
The Zika virus, which is linked to children being born with small heads, poses several challenges. Right now, diagnostic tests are imperfect. There's no treatment, and there's no vaccine.
As the Secretary said,
Dr. Anthony Fauci, head of the Infectious Diseases Branch of the NIH, says the outbreak is a pandemic.
You have multiple countries in South America and in the Caribbean. So by anybody's definition, that would be considered a pandemic.
There's concern the virus will eventually be found in mosquitoes in the U.S.
If you have this much Zika in South America and in the Caribbean, sooner or later we're going to see a local transmission.
Fauci says controlling mosquitoes that could carry Zika is key. And the United States has one big advantage.
Most of the United States goes through a real winter. And that's very, very important in containing mosquito-borne viruses.
So the Zika virus is really becoming a bigger issue. And specifically, this relates to Texas. So if we look at the next figure, we show that when we're looking at the mosquitoes most likely to carry the Zika virus, you know, East Texas is really going to get hit hard by this. And while, you know, while the U.S. has probably a better infrastructure for controlling mosquitoes than you're seeing coming out of the Latin American countries, you should still see a significant effect. But furthermore, what complicates this is really the budget problems in Louisiana. So East Texas, because of the budget problems in Louisiana, that they may not have the infrastructure to do this. And so you may need the federal government to step in to help out not only Texas, but also Louisiana to care this. And this presents a great deal of questions, specifically the fact that while the Zika virus itself is a non-lethal virus, it is linked to birth defects. And while some people have kind of questioned the extent to which it is linked to birth defects, there's growing evidence showing that. And so, one, we run into this problem of, okay, how do we control the mosquito population? How do we keep the public health of, you know, of the southern part of the United States safe? But in addition to that, what do we do about these possible birth defects? So a lot of countries are saying, you know, don't get pregnant, which means support for contraceptives. And even the Pope has come out and made an argument that has, you know, not necessarily been anti-contraceptive, But it said, you know, contraceptives are not the most evil thing. So now we run into issues of contraceptions. But also, when it comes to the idea that the child might be born with a birth defect, there are concerns about abortion. And if we look at the recent Texas poll, this was done in 2014, you find about, you know, more than half of Texans believe that it's okay to have an abortion if you believe there's a serious birth defect with a child. And so this raises a great deal of policy questions of how do we deal with this? Because as we were talking about earlier, you know, it's really hit Puerto Rico pretty hard.
Yeah, and Puerto Rico, remember, is a U.S. territory. And there have been, I think, roughly as many cases that germinated inside Puerto Rico as have been transmitted into the United States by people traveling already. So that's going to be a serious problem. I think the way you're talking about it is really makes sense. From a political point of view, you have two big areas of social policy that are very active in the United, or policy that are very active and important in American politics. One, this issue of state-federal relations. As Eric was saying, Louisiana is undergoing a severe budget crisis. Texas is not undergoing a severe budget crisis right now, but there are some pretty serious clouds on the horizon. These are both states that have spent the better part of the last decade or more criticizing the federal government, trying to tell the federal government to stay out of state politics and state budgetary matters, who may very well need to turn to the federal government for help in something like this. And then, of course, there's the issue of social policy. Because the Zika virus is intersecting with abortion, as Eric was saying, it's sexually transmitted, so there's going to be these issues of contraception, public health issues, you know, related to sexuality. We're going to run into that as well, and you're going to get some of these questions like we're seeing the Pope engage.
Yeah, and so this raises a high level of questions in terms of what are we going to do, what are we going to see in terms of not only federal policy, but also how state policy might change. So Texas is a low tax, low service state. And so do they have the infrastructure to carry this out? And it's been pretty much well established that Louisiana's infrastructure to carry these things out has severely been depleted. And so this is one of the things to really pay attention to as things go along. Again, now while this disease is not a deadly disease, people are not dying from the disease, it is linked to serious birth defects. And so this may have an effect on, you know, generations to come. Now, another issue that's come forward that's been a bit of a conflict has been really the federal government with Apple over the iPhone. Let's roll a real quick clip of that.
It's a move Apple CEO Tim Cook is calling unprecedented and a threat to the security of customers. A judge is ordering Apple to help the FBI break into a cell phone used by one of the San Bernardino shooters. The FBI is asking to disable an iPhone security feature that locks out users and erases the phone's data after the wrong password is entered 10 times. Cook says that would mean building a new operating system with potential to unlock any iPhone. He says if the FBI could use it as a backdoor into your iPhone, hackers could too.
So the way Zika pits the federal government against state government and kind of involves those kinds of issues. In this case, we see an area where the federal government tends to get a bit more support, because it seems like in terms of this privacy in the iPhone versus national security concerns and the federal government's desire to get in the phones, public opinion is divided, but not that closely. In a lot of ways, people siding with national security, I think.
Yeah, you're seeing that. If we take a look at a Pew poll, we find is about 51% of the public believes in unlocking the phone. Now, again, you have more than a third who say do not unlock the phone, but you also have a lot don't know. And this should be expected. I mean, this is really an issue of civil liberties versus national security, and this is going to be a major issue. And if you look at iPhone users, even among iPhone users, there's a good amount of support for it. Again, with 51% saying unlock the phone, 38% saying don't unlock the phone. But again, you know, it's kind of a tight one there. Now, what's further complicated this is that while you have one federal judge saying that they should unlock the phone, you have another federal judge who's actually said which is a stay that order from the FBI, saying that they don't have to unlock the phone. Furthermore, there have been accusations that the FBI has tried to unlock the phone and they had some type of mishap which caused this. And so basically what the FBI wants Apple to do is create a program which allows us to input, I guess there are over 10,000 codes you can put in, to put these in over and over again without the phone locking up, and that it's automated, so you don't have to put it in by hand. And again, the FBI doesn't know what's on the phone, but they're trying to get as much information as possible. And so it's really a fight that may not turn up much information, but the idea here is we need to get this information. We need to get as much information as possible to see what's going on, because this was a deadly, you know, terrorist attack, and we need to understand who was involved. And again, it's a really good example of where you're seeing basically rights and values being pitted against each other, where you have civil liberties being pitted against national security.
We've seen this over and over again, and the pendulum has kind of swung back and forth with discussions of the NSA and metadata, et cetera. So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. And I thought the government actually took an interesting way of counterpunching when they said that Apple is really not concerned about your civil liberties. They're just trying to further their brand, which is, you know, a pretty interesting way of fighting against, of pushing back against Apple.
Yeah, the fact that it's about a market share is pretty important. And the fact that Bill Gates has sided with the government almost makes it look like it's a fight over market share. And I guess with all the movies coming out about Steve Jobs and how he's not the, I guess, most scrupulous individual, you could buy into that argument. But at the end of the day, you know, it could be, in a way, it's a civil liberties versus national security argument, and we'll see how this all comes
out. There's a lot of civil libertarians and libertarianism inside the technology committees. You really do have a sense that Apple's playing to their crowd without discounting the fact that they have, you know, some legitimate issue. You know, there are legitimate philosophical issues here. So we want to close today by talking a little bit about something much closer to home. In Travis County, in the election last Tuesday, as the dust was settling on the big pictures of Super Tuesday, it also became clear as early as election night that a couple of funny things had happened on the ballot in Texas, and in particular in Travis County, which is the county in which Austin, the UT Austin, is located, for those of you that pay no attention to local government whatsoever. So deep down on the Republican ballot in the Republican primary was a contest for the Travis County Republican chairman. And this is just the person who sits atop the administrative position in the party. It's not a public position, he's not a public official per se, but the person who has this position has a ranking position that has organizational responsibilities inside the Republican Party. So Republicans in the party primary vote for this person. And the guy that won is named Robert Morrow. Now, Robert Morrow, largely unknown to most people, but he's actually been on the political scene for quite a while, and he's a fairly unorthodox guy, to say the least. He really came to national attention, at least statewide attention, in 2010 when he ran an ad in a local Austin alternative weekly in which he offered something, I think $10,000 was the amount, for anybody that would come to him with evidence that they had had homosexual contact with the then governor, Rick Perry. He got lots of play for that, a fairly unusual political move. And now the guy resurfaces 6 years later, having won the Travis Park County chairman. Now, he won mainly by a quirk of the ballot, we think. There were only two people on the ballot. This measure was way down on, you know, page 5 or 10 of the ballot. But because he was first, he probably won for that reason. We know from research that ballot order matters. It's one of these things that has nothing to do with democratic preferences or our ideals of democracy. We know that if you're deep on the ballot and it's nobody knows who's on there, you can win with, you can gain as much as a point and a half to, in some research shows, as much as 4 or 5 points even, and that can really make the difference in getting elected. Now, the night of the election, I was watching election returns with a bunch of people, and I noticed that he had won this, and I found an article on Twitter and tweeted it out. And we began to see what this guy was like. So I tweet this, and then Morrow responds to me within an hour or so on Twitter with one of his, you know, signature lines, in which he says, "Much of the Bush family should be in jail. Rick Perry was a rampaging bisexual adulterer." Now, this is obviously coarse language, very coarse discourse. There's no evidence of any of this, of either of these things. But this was the beginning of Robert Morrow going on a rampage on Twitter. By the weekend, he was on the John Oliver show, and we can't even really show a video clip or play an excerpt of that, because between Oliver and Morrow, there's just not much, you know, many clean passages. Nonetheless, he got then another big national push, another explosion of things on Twitter. His Twitter feed is just a parade of obscenity and semi-pornographic pictures. In response to John Oliver paying attention to him, he tweeted that he owned the expletive-deleted internet for a week, hello, which is actually one of the more mild things you'll find on his Twitter feed. So this really is a weird story, a funny story, but also tells us a little something about the weakness of parties as organizations. I mean, we're struggling to make an academic point here.
Yeah, I mean, when we think about the pig, the poe, and the pie, so party and government, party in the electorate, and party organization, this is a story about party organization and how the organization may not be doing right. We could argue that Trump is an example of the party in the electorate and some issues associated with that. And then furthermore, we could argue that what happened with John Boehner being pushed out and being replaced is an issue of party and government. All three of these are different aspects of party and party power. And the Republican Party seems to be, at least within party and government, they seem to be shored up with the election of Paul Ryan as the speaker, but they were a little bit shaky there. Part of the electorate, there's a little bit shakiness there because of the Trump. And, you know, part of his organization, I think for the most part, they're fine. But in Travis County, there may be some issues.
Man, you are good. You got from Robert Morrow to John Boehner in like 15 seconds.
I got to keep this for the children now. this is a family show. But yeah, again, just trying to make sure we can link this back to something academic. No matter how hard we try, we didn't even get a chance to talk about the woman running for the state electoral board who, what was her name again?
Yeah, State Board of Education, Mary Lou Bruner, who was also made it into the Oliver segment, who thinks that Barack Obama was a male prostitute.
Yeah, paid for his drug addiction throughout college. Right. So,
good times in the Travis County GOP.
Yeah. So again, I'm not really sure where that one falls in party electorate or party organization, but hey.
I think that transitions us to we're not going to be back for spring break.
Yes. So we're going to take...
maybe ever after, you know, this podcast.
We're going to take a week off to basically, after reading all this and thinking about this, I need to kind of wash my mouth out and my brain out because, Lord have mercy, I'm starting to worry about the future of Travis County. Sometimes I start listing the house for sale. But all jokes aside, we will be back in 2 weeks with another In the News segment. We hope you all have a good spring break and enjoy the rest of your week.
So long.
The Government 310 In the News podcast is hosted by Drs. Jim Henson and Eric McDaniel and is produced by the Liberal Arts ITS Development Studio and the Department of Government in the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.